Get your daily market recap on the latest stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. This is important. It is that every equity strategist has a certain style. The acclaim of Jonathan Golub at Credit Suisse, either Courageous Bull or right now with some real reticence, is he dives into sector analysis over on page 5 and page 6 of his reports. He darkens the door this morning. What does the sector analysis tell you right now?
Well, we put out a note this morning on earnings that we're having a margin problem in the vast majority of the sectors, with the exception of, surprisingly, consumer discretionary is better, energy is better, and industrials. But short of that, you're seeing margin contraction everywhere. But if there's a big sector story, it's that tech is really weak compared to everything else, or broadly defined tech. And that's just not something we're used to. The tech is the, this earnings season, if you take tech out, or tech, you know, broadly defined, you have a 5% EPS growth this quarter. I mean, who would think that tech is the thing that's holding everything back? And I think that this continues for longer than we think.
And this is a hallmark of Credit Suisse, is this linkage between strategists and your securities analysis. Do your tech people as a whole feel news-making layoffs can adjust those margins? Can they heal that margin deterioration?
Tom, we were talking before we went on air about what's going on in terms of layoffs and young people coming into the labor market. A lot of this was an overexuberance when we went into the pandemic and things were so strong for tech demand. The companies hired as if this was a new normal of strength. And what it really is, and this is why tech's having a hard time, it was a pull forward of activity. And everyone believed, the investment community bought into it, the companies bought into it, and now it's unwinding. Companies are laying those workers off. So do we work through this? Yes, but we saw this with Y2K. It doesn't happen in two or three quarters. It takes a little bit of time to work through.
Okay, you said a few things now. Y2K, pull forward. And you talked about this can go on longer than people think. So let's build on that. How much did we pull forward, one? And what gives you the sense that this can go on a whole lot longer than people think? And when you say that, what kind of duration are you thinking about?
Maybe this ends up being a 6 to 8 quarter period. I mean, just think about this. You bought a laptop because you're now working from home. When are you buying the replacement for that? Not this year. You went and my mother started using a streaming service for the first time. Is she signing up for the second streaming service now if she wasn't before? And it's not the move towards global advertising, which kind of got pulled forward. And so it's not as if the long-term trend is necessarily a negative one, but there was definitely a bit of exuberance as we went into pandemic, and it just takes a little while. We're also, as an investment community, and if you look at hedge funds in particular, growth in tech has been such a huge win from the time that the iPhone came out in 2008 to now. Everybody staffed up their tech teams. Everybody built processes around it. Nobody wanted to be a value manager. Everyone wanted to be a growth manager. And so it takes a little while for this to kind of play out.
So we're not used to this, and you've mentioned this. This is not what we're used to. And with that in mind, This is the question of the moment, I think, for a lot of people. How compromised is the index story? Because what we are used to and what we're conditioned by is just sitting in the index on the S&P passively and being very rewarded for it. How compromised is that index story going to be for how long?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's compromised. I'll tell you, so last night I had dinner with 10 head traders at some of the bigger shops. And I said, if you had a choice between buying the tech basket cap weighted or the tech basket equal weighted, how many would buy the cap weighted?
What did they say?
Not one hand went up. How many would you buy the equal weighted? All 10 hands went up. And so there's a lot of great names. So if you're trading, if you're looking for individual securities, there's a lot of interesting things going on. But these really big cap, listen, 2-3 years ago, all we were talking about was moats. These are impenetrable businesses.
Secular growth trends.
Yes, exactly. And, yeah. and some of these, and they're great, let's be honest, they're great businesses. But it doesn't mean that they're impenetrable.
So at the dinner last night, which I'm sure you slotted through Credit Suisse Zurich expenses, did you finish, as in the old days of Credit Suisse, with the Hennessy Paradis brandy? Or did you go a different direction now, like get out a six-pack of Unica
Club? Oh, yeah, no, we were drinking light beer, and that was so, yeah. No,
Tell us about this dinner. That's what I want to know.
Well, you know, we do this a fair bit. I mean, next week.
It's your job.
Yeah, and if I look at where my ideas come from, so last night was 10 head traders. Next week we're doing 10 guys who are either hedge fund founders or CIOs at some of the
larger
shops.
What do they want to know from you? Seriously, I mean, we're making jokes about cognac. Forget about that. What do they want to know from you? What's the mystery for traders and hedge funds tycoons when they talk to John Gallo?
If the expectations right now are for weaker, if you look at strategist forecasts, this may be the weakest year I can remember in terms of forecasts. So the question is, if you can't make money just simply by jumping into the market and riding up a beta trade, how do you play the game? Where's that edge that you get in this environment? Because everyone around the table really struggled last year. Managers had a really hard time, especially the hedge funds. So momentum traders have a harder time in this environment. We think there's going to be a big movement. Last year, the whole story was value. People weren't there. We think that growth snaps back this year.
Oh. There's a Gallup we love
and
know.
So, John, why are you only at 40-50 if you think you get that growth snap back given the weighting in this index?
Well, there's a couple of things. One is that this will be a rare year that earnings are down. I'm in the non-recessionary camp, and we can talk about that. But I think this is going to be the rare year that earnings are down in a non-recessionary year. And it's because of margins. I mean, take this earnings season. Revenues are up 4.5, margins down 8.5. I don't remember an environment where we saw that much pressure.
So and it's not Main Street okay, Wall Street bad.
What was that?
Or Wall Street challenged, Main Street okay.
Well, you know, I guess, but I mean, look at what last year was. Wages went up slower than CPI. So companies didn't have to pay higher wages, but they got to move on pricing. That's a beautiful corporate environment. This year, wages are going to be sticky, CPI coming down. They're paying their employees more. They can't pass it on. And so the consumer, the individual is better off this year relative to companies. Last year, it was the opposite. Companies were better off.
I want to talk about that recession call if you can stand it a bit longer. Tom and I just have one question. Can we come to the dinner next week? Can
why
we make that happen?
You know,
why are we getting
an
invite to the dinner?
The
we can host. Tom can be at the
Brandon.
Other.
I'll
we can ask questions.
Listen, Lisa has to check her bearishness at the door, though. She can have the cognac at the end. You just have to check
John,
her bearishness.
This is important. I mean, if you're at a Credit Suisse dinner with Gallup, you're getting 100 Oaks de Vie in your cognac, and it's a splendid coppery gold.
Can you give me a price on that?
I don't have a price on it. I can't get there right now. You know, good morning, Zurich.
John, we're going to force you to stay with us for a few more minutes.
We are with Jonathan Gallup. We're going to continue right now. Global Wall Street giving a nice response with this, the gentleman from Credit Suisse. John, I'm going to go back. And, of course, we have to use the Dow Jones Industrial Average in honor of Lou Rukeyser. 1974, the bottom. World's coming to an end, sort of like now, sort of like 1788. The Dow, 616 to 852. And the next year, we enjoyed going from 852 topping out above 1,000. We were up 38% off the gloom of the 73-74 Pittsburgh's going to die recession. Is that where we are right now?
You know what I would love to, you know, I think what every strategist wants to see is that the Fed crashes this thing, we get a really hard recession, you get a V-shaped bounce, and you get a normal cycle. And I think, I mean, you know, we were talking about just a moment ago how the strategist expectations for this year are as weak as, you know, as we can see. And I think that the idea of a soft landing is way more likely than people think, but it's not something to get excited about because it also means that you're looking at anemic returns with a lot of volatility.
Wait, but if we get a soft landing, does that express out to a 38% up like 1975?
I don't think so. I think that what you're looking at here is the Fed doesn't raise rates enough to crush the... Listen, this, here's what people are getting wrong in this inflation story. It's the headline CPI is falling, but wages are not falling, services are not falling, and rents are not falling. It's goods that are falling, which means that we're not really addressing the underlying cause of this thing. So the market is getting very exuberant that the Fed is going to pause. They're not pausing because they're stopped. They're pausing because they need more data. They want to slow this down a tiny bit. The street's looking at that wrong. The market sees falling inflation. They're getting really excited about that, but it's goods, and that's a comps issue. It's a one-off thing. It's not that we've gotten rid of inflation. It's we've gotten rid of that component temporarily. And so what I think you're going to see, like last year, a lot of chop without a lot of upward movement. And that's a hard, Tom, you were saying this before, it's a hard investment environment for most people, especially those who are shorter term.
At the epicenter, though, of your call is that you think recession is avoidable. You think we will avoid that. What gives you the indication that we will?
The big surprise this year is that if the consumer gets what looks like, let's say, a 5% raise, or for that matter, retiree gets an 8.1% COLA. So they're getting a lot more money. And we end the year with, you know, 2.5% or 2% inflation, which is roughly what the break-evens are saying or the Bloomberg survey is saying. This will be a great year for consumer purchasing power. Their wages are going up higher than inflation. And in that environment, I mean, you've seen now we're 6 months in a row of consumer confidence rising, and we're going to see that all year long this year. And
Well,
just think about it. Jobs are abundant. Your raise is going to be running at 3% above your cost of, you know, a cost of purchasing things, and that is going to keep us out of this recession. Now, from a profit perspective, companies have to pay those higher wages and don't get pricing power. So you have this weird thing that the consumer's okay, the recession gets pushed off, but corporate profits are really anemic, and investors are shaking their head because they don't know what to do with it.
So pick a sector, discretionary.
Yes.
Where's discretionary in that world?
If you are a company, that like a retailer that has a lot of labor, you're going to have a harder time. If you have a business model that is less labor intense, you do pretty nicely.
You know, I took the Dow math that we were just doing here. In 1975, up 38%. In 1976, up 17%. And that obscures that over a 49-year period without dividends, the Dow or the S&P was up 5.4%. You overlay on dividend reinvestment, I get it. When you go to work or when you have a fancy dinner with 10 fancy people like John Farrow, is it a single-digit return world for you? Or can we get back to 9 or 10 or 11, a small double-digit return?
It's a lower return world. So we're talking about what was the group saying? I surveyed the group. I asked, how many of you have taken some of your equity money personally and moved it towards something that looks like a bond? And the majority of the table said, how do you not? And that doesn't mean they weren't saying I'm panicked about equities. But if you can get, you know, after-tax equivalent of 4.5% on a muni bond, do you put something in? Is that attractive compared to a world where you're looking at negative earnings growth?
Does anybody in the dinner look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or do they only look at the Standard & Poor's 500?
Only, you know, I don't want to say dinosaur, but there's not a lot of people who talk about the Dow Jones.
I have that on the record? Can you actually just say it? Because I'd love that.
It's all S&P, TK. You know that. It's all S&P.
I have not any acquaintance with that.
But the S&P story, and I want to finish on this because it is important, has become the dominant story, particularly over the last decade, because it's rewarded investors so handsomely. You mentioned the equal weight if you had to pick the tech sector right now, would you take it market cap weighted or equal weight? That was a conversation you were having about these investors at these hedge funds. Can you tell me about where you'd leave that story now at the index level on the S&P 500? Would you want a market cap weighted exposure waiting for the tech snapback that you're looking for? Or would you want something more equal weight? How would you get your exposure?
I don't have a bias against a cap weighted benchmark, but the outlook has to be for at least the next 24 months has to be that an equal weighted benchmark does better. And it's because I think that some of these larger companies, it's harder for them to deliver an above average growth rate given their size in perpetuity. But I think that there are areas that are smaller in the benchmark. Energy, for example, underrepresented in the benchmark, really low PE. If energy does well, the cap weighted benchmark will lag. And so, yeah, you have to go that way.
John, this was great. Love it. What restaurant are we picking? What cuisine? What did you choose?
He's picking the drinks.
TK's doing the drinks. He'll choose a bar. That's what he always does. Usually at the hotel. It's always a hotel bar. What is it with you in the hotel bar?
They're just really good service as a general rule. They're quiet, and critically, with a lot of the conversations I have, particularly with the wonderful people of Bloomberg LP, I don't want to be sitting next to somebody taking notes from somebody. I mean, they're just quieter. They're unlike the trashy disco scenes you're going to.
Are you saying I go to the disco scene?
You go to they got the ball going around and they're down on
a disco ball.
River. Well, what's it called?
What decade is
that? You have the thin tie, that whole disco thing. Yeah.
Sure. You think this is disco?
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Andrew Hollenhorst with a spectacular call last year on a regime of higher interest rates, and that's where we are. Except at Citigroup, they went from 50 beeps to a quarter of a percent, 25 beeps on the February 1st Derby. So what this is about is Hollenhorst at UCLA learning that one day at UCLA, they actually taught John Maynard Keynes, when the facts change, I change. And Hollenhorst said, what do you do? What did you do yesterday to go from 50 beeps to 25 beeps?
Well, thanks a lot, Tom. Yeah, that's right. When the facts change, you do change. And I think we saw in the data a little bit of softness in the price data. Certainly, we've had softer core CPI readings. And then producer price index usually doesn't get a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. It definitely got our attention. That was a little bit softer also. It means core PCE inflation is going to be a little bit softer. So I think there's enough softer price and wage data for this Fed to, I think the way they're feeling now is comfortable that they've maybe done enough or getting close to having done enough. I am quite uncomfortable that they've actually done enough here. And I think we're going to see that in some of the upcoming data.
Let's talk about the uncomfortable reality of the x-axis in economics. So you've adjusted for February 1, but the cumulative path out into 2023, does that still give you your high newsmaking terminal rate?
So we're still at 525 to 550 on the terminal rate. And I would just highlight, relative to what I'm hearing Fed officials talk about, relative to what markets are pricing, it would seem to me that that is at the lower end of what would be a reasonable terminal policy rate for this Federal Reserve. So it's very possible, it's our base case, that they're getting to this, you know, 5.25 to 5.5% range. But just like your previous guest was talking about, if we see wage growth that picks back up again, and we think it will over the course of this year, if we see service inflation that stays sticky, then we may see this Federal Reserve reassessing, is that really the appropriate policy rate to get to? So although we're hearing Fed officials saying we're going to stay the course, and it maybe makes sense to move at a slower pace now to figure out where that rate is, you know, will we really be seeing the policy response that you need to slow down the economy sufficiently, to loosen the labor market, to bring down inflation?
I don't know if Willem Bouwder, who founded Modern Citigroup Economics, and onto Catherine Mann and onto you, but I'm going to suggest Professor Bouwder studied his A.W. Phillips curve over at LSE a long time ago. Link this to unemployment, and if I get Hollenhorst gloom of a higher rate, what does that do to the unemployment rate and the societal change that will bring?
Yeah, so I think that is something that I think Fed officials need to be really honest about when they talk to the public. The idea that the way monetary policy works is through things like the unemployment rate. It is by slowing down the economy, it is by creating slack in the economy, and is damping demand through those channels. So if you think that this is an economy where demand is outstripping supply, you will need to lean against that with higher policy rates, and that probably will increase the unemployment rate. Now, they have that in their forecast, but they have the unemployment rate coming up to maybe 4.5%. When you're running substantially above target inflation, we still are, even though we've had a few months of softer core inflation, we still are substantially above target. You probably need that unemployment rate to move further than 4.5%. So we're probably going to need to see a 5% plus unemployment rate to bring inflation down. Certainly, can we be hopeful? Could we be hoping that we're going to get a better scenario where the unemployment rate doesn't need to move as high? Certainly. And you know, I think I would hope for that. Everybody would hope for that. But the honest answer to your question, the basic macroeconomics, is that to bring wage growth down, you need to loosen the labor market.
We got to remember, the gentleman from UCLA, Alan Meltzer, wrote a modest 3,000-page history. The only one I know who's read it is Mike McKee. And come on, Andrew, if we societally, coming out of this pandemic, shift from 3.5% up to the Hollenhorst 5%, there is going to be a societal scream about that. Politically, how does the Federal Reserve adapt to that?
Yeah, I think this is one of the reasons that central banks globally and in the U.S. have been made independent, and the idea that they're supposed to operate outside of politics, because politically this is a very difficult thing to do. Now, the education that needs to happen—
Is it happening now with these speeches and the silly micro-parlor game that we're doing?
I don't think so. I don't think so.
How do they educate?
So first, you know, be honest. There were large errors in policymaking that led to much too high inflation. We're now recovering from that period of time. And the recovery from that period of time means much tighter monetary policy. So we're in a bad position, right? We should acknowledge that. Now that you're in this bad position, how are you going to get out of it? We could say, let's just accept higher inflation, right? And this was, in some ways, this is what happened in the 1970s. So we know from that experience that that actually leads to worse longer-term outcomes. So if we try to pivot too strongly towards worrying about issues regarding growth and unemployment, of course we care about those things, but the bigger risk right now is inflation. And that's why it's been interesting in the Fed speak, right? Because we've heard Fed officials saying, yes, inflation is still the bigger risk. But meanwhile, we see markets that are pricing out future Fed hikes, pricing out more hawkish policy, and Fed officials being relatively accepting of that. And so I think, you know, we're not there yet, but this is kind of the early stages of something that could end up looking like the 1970s, where you essentially declare victory before that victory is really attained.
Well, we got a lot to talk about. We're going to expand this interview out to 3 hours at the end of Hollenhorst as we buy back to the 70s. I don't want to get you in trouble with the general counsel Citigroup or with Ms. Fraser, but I'm going to ask a delicate question. Your giant and one of my heroes, Catherine Mann of MIT, is over holding court at the Bank of England, I would perceive as a hawk. Is there a Catherine Mann at the Fed right now? Is anybody at the Fed a legitimate Catherine Mann hawk?
I think what the Fed is trying to do is be data dependent. And I think that is the right thing to do. You want to watch the data as it comes in. Certainly, if we are going to get inflation and wage growth cooling off and we can keep the unemployment rate at a 53-year low, that's something that we would love to have happen. And you have to put some probability on these kind of surprising but possible outcomes, right? And the data most recently has been favorable for that type of outcome. So I think that it's not incorrect to be paying the data its due attention. On the other hand, I think what we've heard in the rhetoric, I think Chair Powell has actually been quite on message in terms of talking about resolve in the face of higher inflation. The idea, if you looked at those last minutes from the December FOMC meeting, and they talked about our markets misperceiving our reaction function, our markets thinking that we're more dovish than we are, and they're concerned about that. So you see that level of concern there. You see that kind of hawkishness. I think the issue for Fed officials is that as soon as you get a short period of time, which we've had a short period of time where the data comes in a little bit more favorably, it's very hard to maintain that messaging. Okay. And that's what they're struggling with now.
With time, I got like 8 ways to go here, folks. If you're just joining us on television and radio, Andrew Hollenhorst of Citigroup with one of the great calls of 2022. For this Fed meeting, he shifts 50 beeps down to 25. I heard a little bit of yeah, but there, maybe back to 50. But he maintains this higher interest rate regime, as Dr. Ellerian and Dr. Dudley speak about, is well. I've got to go, I guess because of time, to the glide path and presumption of disinflation. Is it, even if it's curvilinear down to 2%, or dare I say, Olivier Blanchard, 3%, are there kinks along the way, or is there a good force here to keep disinflation smooth and stable as a trend?
So there are always kinks along the way, and that's important to keep in mind. The softer core CPI prints that we've had, softer core inflation prints that we've had most recently, that has a lot to do with used car prices coming down, goods prices
chunky
that have slowed more down.
Stuff.
Chunky good stuff. Those used car prices, we monitor the wholesale prices for used cars, and we've seen those stabilize and now start to go higher, actually. So when we're looking at January core inflation, February core inflation, you won't have that same disinflationary factor from used car prices. What does help you glide down is shelter prices later this year. I think that will cool. We have a lot of evidence that that's going to cool. Non-shelter services, it's a mouthful to say. That is the area we should be concentrated on, because that's where that wage pressure matters. That's where tight labor markets matter.
Disinflation dynamic and this non-shelter, which I can't pronounce, okay? Great. Bring that over to an initial claim statistic where you would begin to see evidence of Fed success. I'm going to suggest that number's way more ginormous than a 4-week moving average of 206,000.
You know, incredibly low initial jobless claims, incredibly high rates of people quitting their jobs, right? And that's important, I think, when we look at some of these headlines about layoffs. If you have layoffs that's showing you that, yes, there's some areas, some sectors where maybe you're getting some loosening in labor markets, but if you have very few people filing for jobless claims, filing for unemployment insurance, if you have people that are very historically willing to quit their job because they feel so good about the labor market, that's saying to me this is still a very, very tight labor market.
You're becoming a pro like Catherine Mann. You didn't answer my damn question. Answer it. What's the initial jobless claims number, Andrew, that equates into a constructive Fed policy? Is it 250? Is it 300?
Yeah, I think you'd expect to see that coming up to something more like 300. You'd see that coming up over time consistently. And we really haven't seen anything like that in the data.
Extraordinary. What are you going to write about this weekend? What are you going to think about this weekend? I'm reading Olivier Blanchard's new book, cover to cover, every footnote. What are you doing?
We are thinking about what this process will be between the tight labor market and wage relationship, and then between that wage and price relationship. And I think those are kind of the big unknowns right now. So, you know, it's not hard to believe in very tight labor markets pushing up wages. Is that wage pressure then going to push up prices further? We think so, but margins are also wide, right? So maybe
when you talk to Suvin Horowitz and the other criminals at Citigroup and securities analysis, are they telling you these corporations have pricing power?
Especially in the services sector. That's where we still see the pricing power. So goods, very maybe not so much, but in services, yes.
This has been great. Andrew Hollenhorst with a clinic there on how you get to a 25 basis point idea for February 1.
Kelsey Barrow, I think on the same page, portfolio manager. Kelsey, it's wonderful to catch up. You've heard all this communication from central banks worldwide, from the ECB, from the Federal Reserve as well. Have we seen peak rates, and how far can this Fed take things?
Yeah, so I do believe we've seen peak rates, particularly as it relates to the long end, 10s and 30s. But there's this motto, higher for longer, right? I think this higher for longer motto could be the new transitory. So let me explain exactly why. So the Fed was saying transitory, transitory, transitory. Inflation is transitory. The market didn't believe it. They looked through it. They priced ahead of the Fed. They pushed the Fed to hike more. Now we're seeing actually the reverse. The market is saying, let's keep rates higher for longer, higher for longer, higher for longer. And what is the market saying? I don't believe you. It's cutting in, it's pricing in rate cuts. It's already seeing the data roll over. And so the Fed's going to keep trying to communicate higher for longer, but the market is already looking through it. The Fed, the market is leading the Fed on the way up and leading the Fed on the way down as well.
You think the market's right?
I do think the market is right. I think the market is seeing things in the data. You highlighted is a manufacturing. It's been below 50 for 2 months. We don't just look at the headline index. We dig into the numbers. For instance, you look at the ratio of new orders to inventories. New orders is falling. Inventories is rising. Not a good situation for companies. That level has never been this depressed outside a recession. I think it's just a matter of time before we see in the initial jobless claim numbers what we're seeing in the rest of the economy.
What do you see in vanilla corporate debt? You don't remember when there was a blue S&P book and you'd thumb through it to see what Boise Cascade was doing with their massive 3% coupon. But corporate debt matters, and now there's a lot of issuance as well. What's that dynamic? How do we take advantage of that?
Yeah, so we do see a lot of opportunity in investment grade credit. We think that the yields there are attractive to get invested, and we're staying very high quality.
What's a typical yield there? Very high quality corporate.
So you can get between 5% and 6%, you know, depending on the maturity, depending on exactly.
Yeah, that's almost what triple leveraged all cash does. I mean, it's not there yet.
How's that portfolio doing?
It's doing good. I mean, it's really out there with a nice pop, but netted to the twos twenties take. It's,
crazy inflows for you last year.
It was amazing. But if you take out the 2 and 20 fee on the triple leveraged all cash, it doesn't get down to Kelsey's.
We need to talk about high yield. Never mind IG. You've talked about where you're at on this economy. Some people might be different. They might look at jobless claims and say we're still resilient. What recession? You're on the other side of that. I get it. So Treasury yields have peaked. You think ultimately the Fed can't go as far as it goes. Got all of that. What business does high yield have rallying in that world?
So we were talking to our portfolio managers within our high yield desk this week. And yeah, I mean, we were getting that same sense. We're not seeing huge demand into high yield so far this year. What we're seeing, I think, is more technically driven. There's no supply. So essentially, the people who are looking to get invested are just driving spreads tighter. It is incongruent with the data that we're seeing. I think it is more technically oriented. And we're still staying defensive, looking forward to what the data is telling us and what company earnings are going to say, which, you know, we're not particularly constructive on.
So this is just the sales force of all these big asset managers going around saying, buy fixed income. It's all the inflows in the new year coming into fixed income funds. Ultimately, you think that's going to fade for some of these credit stories?
So when we say buy fixed income, we're focused on high quality. So when you think about somebody investing into the aggregate, that's generally treasuries, mortgages, and investment grade. And so, the whole spectrum of the fixed income universe is going to benefit from those flows, undeniably. But, you know, when we're thinking about adding duration to portfolios, you have to think about not just the mathematical calculation of duration, but the empirical duration. So how does it actually trade when treasuries rally and there's a flight to quality safe haven bid? Investment grade is going to get capital appreciation. Prices are going to go up on those bonds when it's risk off. High yield, if spreads are blowing out, you're not going to get that.
And you expect high yield spreads to blow out this year?
So we are still anticipating a widening of high yield spreads when that recession comes. And timing that recession is difficult. But when we do see that recession, spreads tend to widen to at least 800 basis points.
Guys like you at 60,000 square feet. Kelsey, I love to go to the individual. I'm looking at a high quality piece, which I bought, John.
What was that?
Par. It's like this close as I get to golf.
Was it the Century Bond in Austria?
No. It was better than that. And I've enjoyed the Google piece of 50, this century. Okay, 50. So I'm out 30 years-ish, 2.2% coupon, 2.05. And I've seen a price reduction of 100 down to 64. Is that an opportunity? Something like that? Is that high-quality corporate when a ginormous company like Google is on sale for 30, 40% under where it was?
Yeah. So, you know, within the bond market, to kind of translate that, one of the attractive opportunities that we've been finding is when yields are rising, you're having a lot of bonds that you can buy below par at very discounted dollar prices. And so, yeah, those are opportunities. And we want to be investing in companies where we have vision on the cash flow. We know what they're doing in terms of leverage.
Right. I mean, and then I want to be fair here in that Bob and Kelsey are not in the individual name. That's not their mandate at J.P. Morgan is not to give us individual names. I'm just picking this out, John. I don't think our audience understands yields up.
Price down.
100 to 63 on a 30-year piece at Google, which is not a high-yield bond.
Do you want to take the 30-year piece at a tech company? Can we make it broader than that? Is that the kind of risk you'd want to take?
So I think that we were generally all of last year very focused on keeping both our duration risk and our spread risk concentrating in the front end of the curve. So minimizing the interest rate sensitivity of our portfolios, we thought yields would be rising. And of course, those longer end bonds are going to get hit the most. Now that we're kind of in the reverse of that story, I think that you can feel more comfortable extending out the curve and extending duration of your portfolios to those 10-year and those 30-year high-quality instruments.
Tough times ahead. 25 or 50 at the next meeting.
25. Yeah.
That's it. Everyone's saying 25 now, Tom. 25. Done deal.
Well,
early February.
Yeah, and again, Hollenhorst with us here in the next hour to brief us.
Look forward
us
to it. He's dropped from 50 to 25
too. Yeah.
Yeah. Cassie, this was great.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched Wednesday on Netflix?
I haven't.
That's all we want to know. I've never heard of it. Have I never heard of
this?
It's
the Addams Family.
Who's in it? Do you know who's in it?
I don't know.
Why is it called Wednesday?
Because that's the character of the Addams. John, get with American culture.
I've got no
idea. The Addams Family. Very good.
I've got it.
Nailed that.
Great. That was great. That should be a jingle for the show.
And, you know, my afterthoughts calling me Gomez.
Right.
You know, she's at dinner calling me Gomez. And I'm like, what's that about? But it's just another example, as Geetha said, of their narrow casting to what does Kelsey Barrow want to watch? I mean, they're in Hollywood saying
that. Wednesday, apparently.
Well, I don't know. There's others.
So what does a portfolio manager watch on Netflix? What does a PM do? Does Bob keep you too busy? You don't watch Netflix?
You know, I like the more mindless stuff when I'm watching
Netflix.
Like what? Wednesday is Socrates. Okay,
is that right?
What is the mindless stuff?
You know, a baking show.
Like a baking show.
Cocktail competition.
What's the British baking show? Francine Lacroix's addicted
to it. Yeah, the Great British Bake Off, that thing.
Yeah, that thing. I watched.
They moved networks. They changed the cast. Kind of fell off the cliff.
Can we bring up to date on my portfolio? Maybe Kelsey, hold my hand here. We're on TV. Hold my hand. It's not an HR violation. Austria, 97-year. I bought it. I top ticked it.
Brutal.
140 to 47.
That stuff, when you reflect, Kelsey, just to finish there, on the last decade and what's taken place in this fixed income market, Tom will look back at a century bond. What will you look back on to say, this was crazy?
Okay. $18 trillion of negative yielding debt at one point in the last decade, now completely wiped out. That's pretty crazy. And thinking about this idea of structurally higher yields, are we moving into an era of that? And I know you spoke to Bob about that earlier in the week. You know, what we noticed, this rate hiking cycle, the first time that we've peaked at a higher level than the prior cycle. First time in 30 years.
In the bond market here, somebody else had this. This goes back to the establishment of Nevermore Academy in Jericho, Vermont. 1788 was the last carnage.
To Cassie's point, what Bob said earlier in the week, the first time that we've had a higher high in how many cycles?
30 years.
And Bob is basically suggesting that he thinks we can have a series of higher lows and higher highs at each additional cycle where we get a rate hike in cycle and a rate cutting cycle. I think that's fascinating just to think about unwinding the last few decades. Kelsey, this was great.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
We're going to salvage the show and get you to your weekend thinking and weekend reading about what to do in a multi-asset strategy. And Winnie Bangana deals with this each and every day at Columbia Threadneedle. And all my radar's up on Winnie because so many people are telling me bonds is the only comfort zone. Is that a consensus call? And does that concern you?
Hey, Tom, thanks for having me. It is appearing to be a consensus call, and you know, for two reasons. I think it makes a lot of sense. One, the economic data so far, including the one that came out this week on producer price index, is indicating that inflation has peaked. So all of last year was too much inflation, bad for bonds. This year, very simply put, inflation's peaked. Yields are likely to peak, and that's what we have witnessed in the last 6 weeks or so, yields coming off pretty sharply. The second point from a multi-asset perspective is that they're once again acting like a hedge. So this week we saw Wednesday massive sell-off in equity space, and bonds rallied. So the old ballast question is back on the table again. They are attractive because data is indicating this, and they're acting as a hedge.
Let me go right to multi-asset then. So many of our viewers and listeners are going to say, okay, but I'm pitched by advisors and such, this tranche of fixed income or that. How do you look at the choices to make in fixed income? Is it a duration choice? Is it a credit quality choice? What's the most important factor there?
Both are two levers that bond managers use in trying to beat the index. The fixed income duration is the hedge part right now because as yields come down, duration rallies, and that provides positive returns. And credit is something that we are quite nervous about right now because all indications are that we are having whatever the might be a soft landing or some sort of recession this year. And you want to stay in good quality credits. So we are underweight high yield. We are underweight sort of the riskier tranches of credit and staying in investment grade credit.
What do your equity people say? I mean, Columbia Threadneedle does it all. And I'm interested in the equity prism that you have more focused on multi-asset and fixed income.
Sure. That's a great question. In equities, things are a little more hard to pin down, really, because if we look at the valuation lens on equities, they don't seem to have fully priced in this recession fear that's out there for this year. So in the U.S. space, our managers are staying fairly defensive. They like the good quality components of the U.S. stock markets. But from a multi-asset space, we are seeing attractive opportunities to actually hold emerging market equities where we have a massive valuation cushion that's built up in the last decade or so. And at the same time, there are improvement in sort of the dollar view and the growth prospects from China. So we from a multi-asset desk, are liking emerging market, particularly emerging market Asia. But in the developed market, we're staying high quality.
So we're trying to stagger to Q2. I think there's a huge unknown on Q2. You've been doing this for a few cycles. Are you able to frame out the fourth quarter of this year?
In terms of earnings, you know, the market's doing the standard kabuki it does every earnings season. Expectations are brought down pretty sharply and then they're beaten. And so far, that's all we are seeing in data. And I would say it's early days. Expectations for 4Q is that earnings will be down about 2% or so. And so far, with about 10% or so of earnings that have been released, they're beating those expectations. So we might end up, right, if this current run rate continues, with, you know, flat earnings to mildly positive. But expectations for the remainder of the year for 2023 are quite bleak. Earnings are supposed to go down.
Thank you so much. Enrique Bagano with us here this morning with Columbia. It's Threadneedle. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.